encourage you to keep Deuteronomy 4 open. We'll primarily be there in the passage that we look at today. Deuteronomy 4, if you're wondering why do we read this with our vocab word being idolatry today, hopefully you picked up, it's a lot about idolatry. Deuteronomy 4 is not only the longest and most sustained critique of, prohibition of idolatry in the whole Bible. With Romans 1, 18 through 32, if you want to make a note to yourself, that's another passage you should look at. I just didn't want to distract us by going all over the place. But Deuteronomy 4 is longer. It arguably digs in more. It's also the passage that explains why idolatry is forbidden to the people of God, why it's foolish, why it's destructive more than any other. We are in a series called The Grammar of Faith, where we're taking various vocab words. Last week was that human beings are made in the image of God, Genesis 1. She read Genesis 2, which I'll allude to a bit in a little while. One of the things I mentioned last week, if you weren't here, if you don't remember, is that both because in our English translations in the Old Testament, the New Testament is often obscure because the same word can be translated in different ways. But even more than that, I think because theologically, we just in Western Christianity have not connected the dots on this one as much as I think we should, is I think it is profoundly important to know that both in the Old Testament in Hebrew, what the Old Testament is written in, and in the New Testament in Greek, the word for humans are the image of God, and the word for idols, if you got that out, is icon. We literally just take that over into English, icon in Greek. And in the Old Testament, the word for humans are the image of God in Genesis 1 is the word that is showing up over and over in Deuteronomy 4, that you are not to make a carved image. And even at the beginning of Gen's passage, verse 15 and following, do you notice that? Let's just look at one of them. Verse 15. Beware lest you act corruptly by making a carved image for yourselves in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female. Image and likeness, Genesis 1, 26 to 28, male and female. And all the animals that are mentioned and all the elements of creation, the moon and the sun, are specifically ones that show up in the creation story in Genesis 1. And so one thing I want you to notice, and it'll be a big theme today, is that idolatry is connected to the human vocation to bear God's image. They're not disconnected. One of the great quips, I think, in church history by a guy I've been quoting some recently, Blaise Pascal, who you read in 10th or 11th grade geometry class. Remember Pascal's theorem. He's also a great philosopher and theologian. And here's a great way to tell the story of creation and fall, apart from God coming to redeem Israel, sending Jesus in the world, is Pascal says, here's the story of human history, apart from God's grace. In the beginning, God created human beings in his own image. And ever since, we've been returning the favor. In the beginning, God created human beings in his image. And ever since, we've been returning the compliment. But that's the story of the human history. If you keep your finger there in Deuteronomy 4, and if not, feel free to just listen. Arguably, a good case can be made that 1 Thessalonians in the New Testament is the earliest document we have from the early church. That it's almost certainly one of Paul's letters is our earliest document. There's a debate between 1 Thessalonians and Galatians. One of those two letters certainly is the first document chronologically in the New Testament, late 40s, early 50s. I think a good argument would be made for 1 Thessalonians. So let's say this is as early a peak as we get in terms of what's going on in the early church after Jesus' death and resurrection. And at the end of chapter 1, here's just a passage I encourage you to notice in the future. Paul is basically retelling the story of, I showed up as this Jewish apostle of a crucified, risen Messiah and Lord, told you about him. You guys became Christians. You're still Christians now a few years later. And here's how Paul summarizes and recaps what it means to become a Christian. Verses 9 and 10 of chapter 1 of 1 Thessalonians. For they themselves, these other churches that are hearing about your faith and your love and your obedience, their faithfulness in the church of Thessalonica, for they themselves report concerning you, concerning us, the kind of reception we had among you, that is when Paul first came, telling them the story of Jesus, doing evangelism, proclaiming the gospel, and what happened? He told them the story of Jesus, and what did they do? One, they turned to God from idols to serve the living and the true God instead of implied serving the idols they were serving before. Becoming a Christian is to turn away from idols that you are giving your life, your worship, your love to, and to turn back to the living and true God. Those two descriptions of God, those two adjectives, living and true, are the antithesis of all idols. Idols are false and they are dead. They are deceptive and they cannot give life. and to now wait for his son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus who delivers us from the wrath to come. I don't think that Paul is being uncareful there or being random when he uses this verb to wait. One of the analogies I'm going to use later that is always, I think, a good analogy for sin in general, but I think is a great analogy for idolatry in particular, is idolatry is very similar in its logic to what our culture calls addiction. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, once you've been addicted to something and you're now no longer addicted to it and you're on a healthy path, any former addict or addict knows I am not recovered. I am on the road to recovery. I could slip back into it. And so now that they've turned away from idols to start living in true God, part of their faithfulness to God is waiting, which is patience, which is not having what you fully want yet, instead of going back to idols to try to get now an instant gratification of what they want. And so let's go back to Deuteronomy 4. Karl Barth, I read this last week, has a great line about often it's misunderstood by Christians ourselves that being a Christian is not about being religious. It's not about being something more than or something other than human. Christianity is just calling us back to our humanity, what my friend Protan calls sacred humanism. And in this quote in God in Action, if you remember this, Karl Barth said this, in the church, here's one of the things, the church should be the most humanistic institution in the history of the world, in every culture it's in. And he says, one of the aspects of that is that in the church, the boundaries of humanity are respected and guarded. And then he immediately says, that is, the church does not worship idols. It does not cultivate ideologies. One of the points I'm going to make later, and again, if you just came in or you weren't here at the beginning of your bulletin, there's a famous French painting called The Treachery of Images. Idols always hold out this deceptive promise. So I'm going to talk at the end in a few minutes that there is something in the short term that idols always seem to have an advantage over God. They always seem to have an advantage over following Jesus because they give you a boost. They give you an energy. They make you feel alive in the short run, seemingly sooner and quicker and more immediately than being a person of faith and then honoring God and keeping his commandments. And yet there's always this long range reality that when you worship idols, that they actually dehumanize you. There's a great line that C.S. Lewis has in Screwtape Letters. Never read this. It's a senior demon writing to a junior demon about how to strategically tempt human beings to be fools and commit idolatry. And Screwtape has a great line that is true in every culture in a fallen world, but I think especially true in our culture, is he says to the junior demon, who I think is Wormwood, Screwtape's the older one, Wormwood's the younger one, and he says, here's the trick. Hold something before his eyes that will make him just oh, this will make me happy. This will give me identity. This will give me purpose. And yet you know that in the long run, that it will lead to an ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure. And that's always the path of idolatry. Is early on, it makes you feel more alive. But in the long run, idolatry is profoundly dehumanizing. Idolatry is, and there's many things that can be misunderstood about idolatry. Isn't it just like what ancient pagans did? Like, there's no idols in the public square in New York City. There's no statues of Zeus or animals that we think are God. Like, isn't idolatry even a thing anymore? And it can be misunderstood. Idolatry in its deepest logic is something that, I'll get into this in a second. We all do this. It is impossible to escape from it in a fallen world. I'll talk about how that is, why that is in a second. But here is always kind of the deepest logic of idolatry. It's turning away from your creator that you were created to worship and love and fear and belong to and be loyal to and be satisfied in, whether you perceive yourself to have done that or not, and to turn to something that he created, which is good, but not God, and to expect from it, to relate to it, to try to connect with it in a way that you were only made to connect with God. That's the logic of idolatry. I mentioned this during the confession of sin time a few minutes ago. Augustine is probably the most insightful person in church history on idolatry. And because of his experience, he was an idolater par excellence. He pursued everything in life. He was a deeply vain man. He was almost certainly a sex addict as a young man, even in the middle age. He loved the praise of people. He wasn't necessarily into money as much as some other people might be, but he was a worshiper of idols. And at the end of his life in Confessions, in book 10, when he's finally done with his story, he's now talking about memory. Here's a great description of idolatry. What is, he asks, the object of my love? And he's narrating his earlier experience when he's only looking horizontally in the created world of his experience for what he should love, what he should serve, what he should give his heart to, what he should devote his life to. And as an old man who's been a Christian for many decades, he says, what is the object of my love? Well, when I was young, I asked the earth, and it eventually answered, I am not the one you are looking for. And whatsoever things are in the earth made the same confession. And then I asked the seas and the deeps and the creeping things that live, and they replied, we are not your God, seek higher than we. And I asked the breezy air and the universal air with its inhabitants, and it answered to me, Anaximenes was deceived. He was a guy in ancient world who thought that all reality came from the wind and the air. Ancient pagans were weird. We're also super weird, and people will see us weird in the future. And Anaximenes was deceived. I am not your God. And then I lifted up my eyes, and I asked the heavens, the sun, the moon, the stars, but neither say they, are we the God whom you seek? And I answered unto all these things which stand about the door of my flesh. You have told me concerning my God that you are not he. Tell me something about him. And with a loud voice they exclaimed, he made us. And my questioning was my observing of them, and their beauty was their reply. And so Augustine tells the story of becoming a Christian as the story of learning not to be a junkie and an addict of things that God created, but to turn from that and to worship the Creator. And it's a lifelong reality. One thing that I want to do early on to connect with the last week. Last week, I argued that the image of God is connected to two main things, being a king or a queen of Narnia, who's ruling over God's world, God's kingdom for him, and that in the ancient world, a king could only be in the kind of throne city where he ruled, and he couldn't be everywhere in his kingdom. And so if you walked into somebody else's kingdom, you traveled there, and if you're wondering who's in charge here, the way you would know is that you would see statues that looked like a king that were placed all over his kingdom, and you would look at the statues and be reminded that's who's in charge here. That, in part, is what it means that human beings are made in the image of God. We're not the idea of God. We're not the body of God. We're not the voice of God. We're the image of God. Great translation there really is statue. When idolatry is described as making a carved image, it's using the same word for what human beings are. The second place, and we're going to look at Genesis 2 for just a second, although you don't necessarily need to turn back there, is, and let me set it up with this. Here is something that is not widely known today, at least in the specifics. If you look at almost anything that happens in the Old Testament with the people of Israel, some of you will know this, almost everything about Israel's faith and religion is shared in common in some way with other pagan groups in the ancient Near East. Sacrifice is not distinctive to Israel. Having priests is not distinctive to Israel. Having temples that you think a god or the gods live in is not distinctive. Other religions had covenants long before Israel, laws, prayers, sacred meals where you dined with your God, feasts and festivals, kings that were the son of God who represented him. Now, in all of those, there are differences. For instance, we'll get here someday with this series. We'll do sacrifice on Sunday as our word. Sacrifices in ancient religions were always understood as you providing something for a needy God. Literally, he might be hungry, and you had to bring him part of your food that you killed or that you raised, or at the very least, there was a sense of, there's a lack that this God has, and in bringing a sacrifice, you are, it's kind of a negotiation. You are giving your God something so that he or she would bless you in return. And go read sometimes Psalm 50 with that knowledge. All the cattle of the field are mine. If I was hungry, I wouldn't even tell you. When you bring a sacrifice to me, you are not giving me something I need for it. That's not what this logic is. And so even in the similarities, it's pressing into the differences that's really important. But here is one of the few places where Israel is completely different than all of their neighbors. In every other religion of the ancient world, and even in the Greco-Roman world that early Christianity springs up in the temple where the priests work, there are statues of the God in the Holy of Holies, in the place where the God is said to live. There are images, there are statues in the temple. It might be on the ground, it might be on the wall, but in the place where the priest goes into to connect with God, to be in his presence, there are always statues. And all historians of religion always have a thought of this. Israel's temple is empty. There is no statue. There is no idol in the temple. And yet there's another sense, and here's where we'll jump into the connection. If you read Genesis 2, the way I suggested last week, the Garden of Eden is being described as a temple. All those onyx stones and bdellium, the rivers, the way that Adam and Eve are described as being called to work and to serve the garden, those two Hebrew words only ever together show describe the Levitical priests later on. After they sin, God clothes them in the skin of animals that clearly were killed with sacrifice. The priests have to dress up later on to enter God's presence, and they have to make sacrifices before they go on. Adam and Eve are being described as priests in a temple in the Garden of Eden. But that's part of what it means to bear the image of God. And remember, they've already been described as God's image, which means there is a sense in which in Israel's temple, there is an image there. But it's not a graven image. It's human beings. And so I want you to think about today, but also in the future, the connection between falsely, inappropriately bowing down to something God made and this idea that we are created to be the image of God, that we are created to resemble God. We are created to represent God. By the way, here's another thing to know. Anytime you're wrestling with idolatry or even just reading the Old Testament, it's very easy because the Old Testament is so long ago and the customs of the people religiously are so different from ours. It's easy when you read stories of idolatry, whether in the Bible or in the ancient world, to kind of sneer at these people and be like, how could you think in Egypt that this statue of a cat is your god? And here's the thing. No pagans in the ancient world thought the statue was God. They all knew that the gods transcended the statues, but the statues, the idols, the images were portals. They were conduits. They were mediators that here was where you connected with your God. Here was how you communicated. Here was where you could receive blessing, where you could be in the presence of your God, that all the gods are invisible. Every good Greek knows that Zeus doesn't show up on the ground on a regular basis. And so the idols, the statues, are how you connect. And there is a very real sense in which what we look to idols to be when we look to them like that is what human beings were supposed to be from the beginning. To be a human being, among other things, not just to rule over the world on God's behalf, it's to be a portal, a conduit, a mediator to others and the rest of creation, of God's blessing and presence. A human being would be the one place where literally you would see the invisible God. And yet, because human beings no longer bear God's image in a perfect way, in a good way, God is hidden from us. We usually experience him as absent. We usually experience him as not nearly as compelling as sex and drugs and rock and roll or whatever your idol of choice is. We usually experience him as much more distant from our experience, much less relevant to the pursuits of our heart, because there is a sense in which we experience him as farther away. And yet, the logic of idolatry, here's a great line from G.K. Chesterton, is when a human being ceases to worship God, which our culture largely has, and a person might now understand themselves to be secular, to be neutral, to be an atheist, or as an agnostic, but it's actually not that the person is starting to worship nothing. It's that now he or she will worship anything else. And part of the structure of idolatry is kind of like you are a human being who is going to die someday. We just sang about that. You're mortal. Whatever identity you might choose, you're a fool if you choose an identity where you identify as someone who's immortal, because you're going to die. You can identify as someone who doesn't need food, but you do need food. That structure is built into creation. You cannot avoid the fact that you are worshiping any more than you can avoid getting hungry, then you can avoid dying, or you can avoid feeling lonely when you're not connected to other human beings. This structure of worship is built into us, but in sin, what happens is not that it's eradicated, but that it's misdirected to the wrong things. And so in idolatry, we turn this instinct to worship, to serve, to give ourselves to something outside of us that's greater than us, that's bigger than us, that will give us meaning and fulfillment, will fill the emptiness. We turn into something else. And so John Calvin, this is at the beginning of the bulletin, one of the most famous lines in church history on idolatry, he says, the human heart is a perpetual factory of idols. Every single one of us, from the moment we came out of our mother's womb, has become an expert in inventing idols. And I would encourage you to, if that is new language for you, or if that's like, yeah, like I get that biblically, theologically, but that's not how, if this is not how you're interpreting your experience, if you don't know this about yourself psychologically, sociologically, relationally. I would encourage you, after this sermon, to spend some time in the days to come thinking about this. It's a great song from a Bob Dylan song in the 60s or 70s. There, he just reminds us, you gotta serve somebody. And you do. Every single one of you bows down to and serves something. None of you is a free agent. None of you withholds this. We are all worshiping something. In Jeremiah 2, the logic of idolatry is broken down into these two steps. Here is the great twofold evil my people have committed, God says in Jeremiah 2. On the one hand, they have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. The one place that you could drink and be satisfied, they turned away from it. And second, they have hewn out for themselves empty cisterns that can't even hold water. That's the twofold rhythm all of us engage in our lives. It may be another time in the future. I would just encourage you with this framework to notice. A simple way to put this is that all the things that God has created that are good, really amazing, sex and food, power, money, politics, education, culture, friendships, all these things that are good, they're not meant to be the central thing in our lives. That when we turn to them with inordinate expectation of what they will be, we center our lives around them. I want you to notice this, that something that is meant to serve you, you are now bowing down to and serving. One of the most obvious sociological observations you can make about every culture in the history of the world is that things that are good, things that any honest person would say, this is a good thing, but it's a good thing that in Western culture we value freedom. It's a good thing that honoring your parents is valued in other cultures. It's a good thing that delighting in the creativity of all the directions you can go with food or with art is a good thing, that every single one of those areas comes back to bite us in the butt. Every single one of those areas damages people in the cultures that value them above all else. Freedom, we handle really unwisely and poorly in our culture because not that we shouldn't care about freedom, but it shouldn't be the center. Shouldn't be the center of what it means to be a human being. And therefore, people veer off into incredibly foolish and destructive patterns of life. In cultures where honoring your parents is valued, when that becomes the central value, kids are squelched. Kids are squelched in cultures that value that above all else. In every culture, whatever is valued, and it should be seen as good, when it becomes central, it becomes harmful, and humans end up serving it rather than it serving us. And so I want you to notice this. To the degree, here's a very simple principle. To the degree that you worship God in your life, and you obey him, and that's a big theme in Deuteronomy 4, obeying God's commandments and worshiping him, disobeying God's commandments and turning to idolatry are always linked. To the degree that you worship God and keep his commandments, here's something that's very counterintuitive in our culture. You will experience authority over the created good things in your life. Sex will begin serving you. Food will begin serving you. Art will begin serving you. It will give you real humanizing joy. To the degree you bow down to any of these things in turning away from God, you will begin to serve them. And they will become harmful to you in the long run. Not just dishonoring to God, not just harmful to your neighbor, but harmful to you. It is this inescapable reality. Another time to get into this, Brian Rosner, great theologian on idolatry, says this: in the Bible, there is no more serious charge than that of idolatry. Idolatry called for the strictest punishment. It elicited the most disdainful polemic. It prompted the most extreme measures of avoidance. And it was regarded as the chief identifying characteristic of anyone who is not part of the people of God, namely the Gentiles. The one thing you can always count on for those who are Gentiles outside of the people of God is they are idolaters. It's the one thing you know about them. This is not supposed to be true of us in the people of God. In the Old Testament, there are two overarching created categories that are connected to idolatry. In theory, everything that God created is a potential idol. But two in the Old Testament are especially exalted as a danger. The first is sex. That sexual immorality always follows very quickly in the train of idolatry, not just because if one leads to the other, but because the one horizontally is the mirror image of the one vertically. When the people of God turn away to other gods, God often describes that thing in the book of Hosea as spiritual adultery. It's like cheating on a spouse. And therefore, we begin to do that. We begin to become unfaithful in our sexual relationships too. And the other one is politics. When Israel wants to make a treaty with Egypt or Babylon or wherever to protect them from other people, instead of trusting a God, that power becomes the other category. A sense of we're vulnerable, we're weak, we're not in control of our destiny, but if we did this, we'd be in control. And so power and sex are the two most obvious candidates for idolatry. For in the Old Testament, the New Testament, Jesus in the Gospels, Paul in his letters adds a third, money, greed. Paul says in Colossians and in Ephesians, keep your life free from the love of money. Do not be greedy, which is idolatry. He says in Colossians and Ephesians, Jesus names money as mammon, which is actually the name of a false god. He actually personifies money as an idol that you would serve. And then he says, you cannot serve God and money. And I've said this often, I will say it often in the future. One of the many things that links conservatives and liberals in our culture who identify as Christians is that we're all kind of greedy. Yeah, we can. We can serve God and money. I do it all the time. I have a clear conscience about it. I live for money, and I go to church on Sunday, and there's nothing wrong with serving God and money. And here she's saying, cannot serve God and money. It is either or. So let's talk for a few minutes about the results of idolatry. There's a whole lot we can get into here. I'm going to try to move quickly so that we can hit some of the main themes, but also end in a way that I think will be surprising to you. I want to go in a direction that's often not seen in this area. Here's the first result of idolatry in someone's life, culture's life, family's life, and individual's life that the scripture often draws out. Confusion. Confusion is the result of idolatry. Blindness, hardness of heart. You don't care about the right things anymore. You care about the wrong things too much. Confusion, a sense of you don't really know which way is up and which way is down anymore. The reality is that every evil person in the history of the world, as they do evil, they perceive that they are not doing evil. No one thinks they're doing evil. Confusion is the result. Disorientation. Deception. We begin to put it this way. We begin to misinterpret everything else in creation once we turn away from our Creator. We become estranged from ourselves, from our world, from one another. We become alienated. We begin to feel out of sorts in the world that we are in. It's all rooted in because we've confused the most basic relationship. A second thing is that a word that I like to use for idolatry is in scripture. Idolatry is seen as our meta sin. And I mean that in two ways, both in the sense that it is the origin chronologically of other sins. It comes before other sins. We didn't read it, but in Genesis 3, in Christian history, some of you know this, there's a lot of debate over what is the original sin of Adam and Eve in Genesis 3. And some people think it's pride. Some people think it's lust or it's excessive sexual desire. That's certainly not the case. Some people think that it's unbelief, not trusting in God. I think Genesis 3 pretty clearly, and then the rest of Scripture so clearly lays it out, describes it as idolatry. Eve saw the apple, it's not an apple, it's fruit, whatever fruit it is. She saw, and she saw that it was good, that it was desirable, that it would make one wise, that she began to have an inordinate fixation on it, and it led her to disobey a direct, unambiguous command. By the way, here is another result of idolatry. And this one is challenging, but I want us to hear this. And by the way, when I focus on something challenging like this, I'll try to say this every once in a while. I'll try to imply it. I stand up here as a fellow idolater with you. I stand up here as someone who has been addicted to this my whole life, still addicted to it, who is still on the road to recovery. And so let me say very clearly, this is true in my life, and it's there in Scripture. And so I'm not at all pointing a finger when I say this. The most obvious litmus test for idolatry is not subjective. How much do you care about this? Because subjectivity is subjective. It's hard to know for sure that your bearings. It's the ultimate litmus test for idolatry is where are the areas of your life that you are willing to transgress boundaries, that you are willing to disobey clear commands, that you're willing to say, like the serpent, did God really say that? where are the areas where you are not staying within the limits of a creature and that you are willing to transgress? You are willing to go somewhere that is forbidden. You are willing to commit violation. If any of you ever cheated on a test at some point in high school or middle school or college, that told you something about your value system in that moment, if you were awake. If you are willing to cut corners to make more money in your job, if you are willing to do things at your job that not only don't serve the world around you and help your neighbor, but actually harm the world because of the status it offers, the money, you are learning something about yourself. You are willing to violate very clear commands. If you are someone who lies to your friends whenever it's inconvenient, you are learning something about your value system. The places where you are, where you justify and rationalize to yourself why you're violating clear commands, are always litmus test moments of where the idolatry is. Idols ask us to disobey God's commands in obeying their commands. I've already mentioned this, but idolatry is dehumanizing. It gives rise to all of these other sins. Romans 1 18 through 32 really does that. We turn away from God, and then everything else becomes confused. Every other kind of sin arises out of that. The Wisdom of Solomon is a very famous Jewish document from around the same period of time as the New Testament. Paul actually alludes to it a couple of times. And this is nothing that's not already there in the Old Testament. It's just articulating it in a summary way. The Wisdom of Solomon says this: the worship of idols is the beginning and the cause and the ultimate end of every other evil that human beings commit. It's before it, it's the driving factor for it, and it's what the end game is, which is becoming an idolater rather than a worshiper of God who is made in his image. One of the themes that you will see in terms of the results of idolatry, Psalm 115, Psalm 135, is those who bow down to idols and serve them become like them. That you become like what you worship. And what is that? We'll come back to Deuteronomy 4 in a moment. One of the main characteristics of idols, they have eyes, but they can't see. They have ears, but they can't hear. They're not actually alive, and they can't give life. They don't actually look like God, and so they can't convey God to you, but they're truncated, and just as worshiping God is transforming. When you come to church every week, when you're following Jesus in your own life and with others, every moment of worship, you're not left the same afterwards. You're actually changed a little. Back into God's image, every moment of bowing down to an idol is a transforming moment where you become a little more like this good but not great thing, and therefore you become dehumanized. Greg Beal is a great New Testament theologian, and he has this very simple formula that I would encourage you to memorize. The logic of idolatry in Scripture reminds us of this, that ultimately we resemble what we revere, either for our ruin or for our restoration. We resemble what we revere, either for our ruin or our restoration. Last week, I reminded you of something that I read for years and never noticed until I heard a Tim Keller sermon where he mentioned it. At the end of his life, in this parable, this story that Jesus tells in the Gospel of Luke, there's Abraham's supposedly the guy goes, but there's Lazarus who's poor, and the other guy who's turned away from God and his neighbor for money is just described as a rich man. That he's just become, like he doesn't have a name anymore. He's just a rich guy. That's all he is at this point. He has no deeper identity. He has no deeper pursuit. It's just, now you're just rich. You're not an image bearer anymore. You're not somebody with a name, a son, a daughter, a mom, a dad, a friend. You're just a rich person. You become like what you worship. A guy named Dick Kies, who I got to know in the 10 years I lived in Boston, if you know a ministry called Labrie, which was started by Francis Schaeffer probably 40 or 50 years ago, Dick Kies has led the Labrie in Massachusetts for many decades, and he has the best analogy, the best illustration I've ever heard on idolatry. Here's what's happening every moment you move towards idolatry, especially in a new way. You begin to notice sex or power or money or whatever. You begin to bow down to it and see it as the ultimate thing you're serving. Here's what's going on in those moments in our lives. It's like the people of Troy during the Trojan War who saw the Trojan horse and were like, this is amazing. And they opened up the doors to the city and they brought it in, and they were unaware that there were enemies inside. Every idol you bring into your heart, you need to know there are enemies inside. This will destroy you. Left to itself for long enough, this will be the ruin of you bearing the image of God. I want you to hear again something I said during Confession of Sin before we move on to the end here. And what you do about this. At the end of his life, the Apostle John, who knew Jesus, had his head on Jesus' shoulder, his chest at the Last Supper, wrote the Gospel of John. He's 80, maybe 90 years old now, and he's writing one of his final letters to this group that he knows he won't be here in the years and decades to come if they get older. And the last thing he pleads with them is, little children, guard yourselves from idols. Keep yourselves from idols. Don't give your hearts to idols. This will be the deep ruination of all of us. And so the results of idolatry are profound. One last result of idolatry, and I'm trying to scare you. I want you to be scared of idols in your lives. We're not as scared of idolatry as we should be, is that those who serve idols over and over and over again, we're told that ultimately they will be put to shame, they will be disappointed, they will be embarrassed. There are many things. I'm old enough now. Stephen Romeo is certainly old enough now. All of you are old enough already, if you're wise. Here's one thing that is always a warning sign for me, for somebody in our culture. Somebody who describes themselves as having no regrets. Anybody who describes themselves as having no regrets, I automatically know is a fool. When I look back over the last 43 years of my life, there are a lot of things I wish I had to do over again. Because I now know I was put to shame in my pursuit of that. It disappointed me. It embarrasses me that I gave my life to that. That is the ultimate outcome of idolatry. Futility, emptiness, being put to shame. One of my favorite promises in all of Scripture, those who wait for the Lord will not be put to shame. They will not be disappointed. They will not look stupid when we get to the end of the story. Those who worship idols do. This is a result that is a very different kind of result than the other ones I'm mentioning. But I want to say it real quick. It was in Deuteronomy 4 in verse 24. Some of you will know this. Here's a theme that probably is a bit disturbing to us, but it actually should be beautiful, is that one of the results of idolatry is that it makes God jealous. Idolatry makes God jealous. Now, here's why that's good. If I am jealous that Brandon can play the piano better than I ever could, that is 100% toxic. If Helen is jealous that I'm trying to get other women to sleep with me, which I'm not, that is a good response for her to have. If she was like, just trying to be home by 12, that would actually be a sign of like, oh man, she's really in an unhealthy place in her life, as well as her husband, obviously, that the jealousy is an appropriate reaction to relationships of exclusive belonging. So when you give something, worship, sexual intimacy and ecstasy, something that God made, it draws forth a jealous reaction from God because he wants your devotion and he gives you all of his love. God is jealous, and that's a good thing. That's a good thing. You would often be jealous, especially in a romantic relationship, but in other places in life when there's exclusivity and belonging there, and idolatry is regularly said to provoke God's jealousy. I'm going to qualify that later in a way that I think we don't do enough. There is, as somebody who has recognized for a long time that I am very prone to addictive behaviors in my life, I always have been. I turned to smoking, chain smoker, late middle school, early high school. I have a really hard time being moderate in things that I enjoy in life. Now, in one sense, that's true of everybody, but I really struggle with it. I have to really guard what I do with my body, where I turn my mind to. And there's a great book on addiction, some of you know it, by Gaber Mate, Hungarian-Canadian guy who's been working with drug addicts in Vancouver for decades. It's called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. By the way, that's a great image of idolaters. Idolaters become hungry ghosts. And he says this, but here's, at the end of the book, he says this. Here's something I've learned about addicts. That misplaced attachment to what cannot actually satisfy human beings is not an error that is exclusive to addicts, but is the common condition of all mankind. Mm. And so here's one thing if you want to know, and again, I'm not saying this with a pointed finger, I'm saying this with one of you. Every week I get up here, I know I'm talking to a room full of junkies and addicts. I know I am. Some of you know that about yourselves, some of you don't. But it is true of all of you. When you see a guy who's destroyed his life with drugs on the street, you are seeing a picture of what you are doing in your life somewhere else. This guy is not different than you are. All of us have bowed down to something and become addicted to it for the sense of feeling alive. This is the deep logic of it. And so here's where I want to end. And I want to go in a different direction. By the way, I was talking to G earlier this morning. She mentioned that she found this really helpful in the past. When I was working with college students in Boston for 10 years, we would do a book reading project every summer. And some of the books were okay, some of them not as much, you know, provoking, much good discussion. The book that provoked the most conversation, the most transformation in these students' lives was Counterfeit Gods by Tim Keller. If you've never read this, consider picking this up. The things that I'm only talking about very briefly here, he will get more in depth, and he will help you see how idolatry is a primary category you need to have to interpret what you're doing in your life, to learn how to heal from it, to learn how to name it and see it when it's happening. But here's what I want you to notice is idolatry in Deuteronomy 4, to go back, turn to Deuteronomy 4, we'll end here in the next couple of minutes. Deuteronomy 4, before it gets to the prohibitions of idolatry in the second half, reminds Israel that when you came to Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, you heard God's voice, but you did not see his form. If you heard a voice, but you didn't see a form. Therefore, in verse 15, where Genesis are, therefore, watch yourselves very carefully. Since you saw no form on the day that the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of fire, beware lest you act corruptly and make idols. I want you to notice something about idolatry, and it is very easy to miss. Now, you all know this on some level that you never noticed. If God exists, you can't see him. God exists, you can't experience him the way you do food or sex or the buzz of power after you win an election or your candidate wins an election. The sense that other people are praising you because of the status you've achieved through your accomplishments. All of those things give us a buzz that closing your eyes in prayer does not, that reading your Bible does not, that going to 17 church services a week just does not, if you're willing to be honest with yourself. And by the way, one of the things I'm going to end with in just a moment is the cure, the remedy for idolatry is not, and this is where we really, I think in Western Christianity, we tend to be better at identifying idolatry as a problem and not nearly as good at providing a practical remedy. So a lot of Christians in our culture who can articulate the logic of idolatry who are still completely addicted to it. And so what do we do for a cure? So I want you to notice that the urge towards idolatry in Deuteronomy 4 is this sense that I want to see God, but I can't. And I can see and taste and touch this other thing I'm going to turn to. And so idolatry is always a move you make when you find God to be invisible, not perceptible, not apprehendable, not present, whatever it is. And I just want to remind you from last week that the original vocation of human beings is to bear the image of God. And they are to be. We are to be the statues in the temple, the place that others could come to as a conduit to experience God's presence, to experience his grace, his love, his favor. And if you know anything about trauma, whether in your life or in friends who have trauma, or you just, you know, gotten to know this category as you read, is the most basic trauma that most of us have, at least that we name in our culture, is early family dysfunction. Maybe a parent was not there and took off, and there was an absent parent. Maybe there was a very destructive parent. So whether a parent is absent, you want a parent to be there and they're not, or they are harmful, is for the rest of your life, you're going to have to realize that there's now trauma that is shaping the way you respond to things. And on the one hand, you'll notice, if you don't know this about yourself, that one, you have all kinds of coping mechanisms you didn't choose, but you just intuitively came up with when you were a kid. And on the one hand, in the short run, they were necessary for your survival. And in the long run, they will destroy you if you don't learn how to grow out of them. So there's these coping mechanisms that are there. I want to suggest that here is the deepest trauma we all share as human beings in a sinful world, the hiddenness of God. All of us long to see God, to experience him, to feel like he's there, to feel like he loves us, he knows us, we have a purpose, that we matter, that he's even there. And there is a constant sense that he's not available. He's not there. And what I want to remind you of is that's not because he's not there. It's not because he's punishing us. It's because the way he created the world is that you could only get that through human beings who bear his image. And human beings no longer bear that image. We're now at fast crack mirrors. Here's this bad parent, absent parent. Here's a way to think about it. if you experience loneliness and isolation relationally overall, maybe some of your family has died, or a dad or a mom left, maybe you don't have siblings, or you're not close to your siblings, maybe here in New York City you feel like you don't have many friends. If you experience other human beings as basically not there for you, here's something I want you to notice, and this is true for me, is that you almost certainly will have a harder time having a sense of God's presence in your life. If you had family members who were deeply toxic and harmed you and abused you, I promise you something is true of you. You will find it harder to trust the goodness of God than someone who did not go through that. The traumas we experience with family and other people are always flowing out of the deeper trauma. The reason a dad or a mom, a friend, a sibling did that is because they themselves have this trauma. And so here is something I want to suggest to you. The deepest trauma all of us experience is we wake up every day longing to see God, like Israel did here, and finding he's not there. And you might never name that to yourself. You might go get a PhD in philosophy to deny that that's true philosophically and ethically, but it's what's going on. And here is something that I want to suggest. Here is my ultimate definition of idolatry. Idolatry is the universal human coping mechanism. You were made to see God and to be in his presence and to find life in that. You do not, and therefore you are grabbing onto anything else that will make you feel alive, that will make you feel present. And in the short run, it might feel like it's working. I'm actually not as angry now that I can do this, or I'm not as sad now that I can do this. But in the long run, it's a coping mechanism. It's actually harmful. It's actually dehumanizing you. Idolatry is the universal human coping mechanism for the hiddenness of God, which is itself the result of human beings hiding from God, hiding from the role they're supposed to play in the world is God's image. And so here's the final thing I want to leave you with. The solution, the remedy, the cure to idolatry is not try to be more religious. It's not the solution. It's not, you're only praying 5 minutes a day now, pray 30 minutes a day. You're praying 30 minutes a day, pray an hour and a half a day. You're reading the Bible in a year, read the Bible three times every year. You're going to church on Sunday, go to church on Tuesday and Thursday too. We're singing 4 praise songs. Next week, we're going to start singing 8 praise songs. We're going to get that idolatry right out of you. And then if you're honest with yourself, which many religious people are not, it's very hard for religious people to be honest with themselves when their experience does not line up with their ideology. That's ultimately true for all human beings. Is that at some point you will notice, I'm more lonely than I expected to be. I'm more unhappy than I expected to be. I'm more unsatisfied than I expected to be, because that's not the cure for idolatry. The way back is not to be more religious. And I want you to notice, as we end, that the 4 reasons idolatry is forbidden in Deuteronomy 4, if you didn't notice this, the first one, verses 15 and following, 16, is this, that when you become an idolater, you are asking something that God created to play a role that Deuteronomy 4 describes as the image and likeness of God. When you turn away to an idol, according to verse 16 and following, you are relating to something God created as if it bears his image and his likeness, which it doesn't. The second reason is that when you do it, you're not only trying to connect to it, but you're willing to bow down to it and serve it. That you're willing to give yourself to it if it would give you what it seems to promise to. And I want you to notice or remember that in Genesis 1, only human beings are made in the image and likeness of God. And only human beings are, it is true of, is that the rest of the created order ought to bow down to them and serve them. And so when you turn away to idolatry, you're asking something, let me put it this way, you're asking something God created to play a role in your life that only other human beings can play in your life. Which is why simply being more religious is not enough. The third reason is that every time, if you look towards the end, it is in verse 28, every time you turn away to bow down and serve something that you think is in the image and likeness of God, will give you that grace, that power, that presence, but it's not, is that you fail to realize that it's actually just the work of human hands. Here is something that I'll bet you didn't notice about Genesis 2 when you read it, or even have ever noticed before. In Genesis 1, everything God creates, he creates by speaking. Irenaeus noticed this very early on. How does God create Adam and Eve? With his hands. He forms them. The only thing in all of creation, according to Genesis 2, that is not the work of human hands or the work of God's speech, but actually the work of God's hands, is a human being. And yet every time you bow down to something, think, this is the image and likeness of God, this will give me satisfaction, you are worshiping something that other human beings have constructed, whereas you have been constructed by God. And the last one is this, verse 28, right after the work of human hands, that fourth critique of idols, that they neither see, nor hear, nor eat, nor smell. Often they have eyes, but they cannot see. They have a mouth, but they can't speak. They have legs, but you have to carry them. They will not carry your burdens. So you have to carry theirs. Here is something I want you to notice about yourself. This morning when you woke up, even if the alarm clock went off, you're like, oh, I do not want to get out of bed. As your eyes opened, you saw. As your ears are hearing me right now, your nose can smell things. The ultimate critique of idols is that they look like an image and likeness, but they have no ruach, no breath, no life, no spirit in them. The reason idols cannot play this role is that only human beings can play this role. Only human beings are made in the image and likeness of God. Only human beings are the work of God's hand. Only human beings are meant to be bowed down to and served by the rest of the created order. Only human beings look like God, not just outwardly, but in their ability to be alive and to be true. Walter Brueggemann has a great phrase when he says, the only authorized representative of God in the created order is you. And when you turn away to idolatry, you're asking something else to play the role that you are supposed to play for others and that others are supposed to play for you. And so this is very, very simple, but I really do mean it. Here is the cure for idolatry. It is challenging. It is hard. It will take the rest of your life. On your deathbed, you'll be a beginner at it at best. The road to recovery never recovered. But here is the cure for idolatry. Love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And like Jesus said, those aren't two commandments, they're one commandment. Because you can never love God without loving your neighbor. You can never really love your neighbor without loving God. That is the main thing that goes wrong, is that we are meant to experience God, not mystically, not directly, but through our relationships with one another. And so here is the ultimate answer to why the church matters. Why you can't say I like Jesus, but I don't like the church, so I'm going to be a lone ranger, is we are the temple of the Holy Spirit, and there are statues there that are mediators, conduits, outlets of God's presence and power, and your connection to them will be the measure of your connection to God. The degree to which you serve them and are transparent to them, that you are known by them and know them, will be the measure of your relationship with God, of your experience of him. You cannot be connected to God deeply without being profoundly connected to other image bearers who are following Jesus. You have to be intimate with one another. You have to connect. And so here is a very simple way to put it. And I've often heard Christians say this, intentionally or unintentionally, that just like sex, here's a thing to know about sex. You can love it the wrong way. You can love it in the wrong context. You can love it for the wrong reasons, but you can also just love it too much. Sex, you can just love too much. Money, you can just love too much. A dog, I love dogs. You can love a dog too much. The dog that you grew up with, that you love, that gives you great joy, if you are ever hypothetically in an ethical conundrum where you could rescue this dog's life, or you could rescue the child of a family that you don't know, and if you choose to rescue the dog, you've made a profound mistake. Mm-hmm. Because a human being is the image in the likeness. You can love a dog too much. Here is something I want you to know. You can never love a human being too much. Mm-hmm. It is the one object that God will never be jealous of, because it bears his image. And everybody said, whoa, 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 I need that. I'm really enjoying this small group. I need to really like moderate myself because I'm getting into this a little too much. You can love human beings in the wrong way. You can love human beings in the wrong context. You can love them for the wrong reason, but you can never love them too much. There is no competition between love for God and love for neighbor. There is no jealousy that comes from God. And our love for our neighbor is the way we experience love for God. Our love for God is mediated by the love of neighbor. And our love of neighbor, these two things will always go together. And so when I say don't go off in response to idolatry and try to be a mystic, what I mean is try to be both the reflection of God's image to others and to receive his image from others. This is the road back from being a junkie. It's actually having healthy connections with other people who are healthily connected to their creator. And so there is a sense in which, even with non-Christians, this can be life-giving. but it needs to be people who are themselves worshiping God and following Jesus, filled with the Spirit, not perfectly, but going that direction. Otherwise, there will be something still better than this, better to love any human being more than it is sex or food or power, but ultimately those who are being renovated into the image of God. And so here are a couple of examples that I want to put flesh on bones here. Of relationships. Does anybody remember, and I've never even read all of this, but in Dante's Divine Comedy, I'm mentioning this story, this example, because here's something that I think deep down a lot of you not only probably think, but you kind of dread, which is okay. Like, yeah, along the way, God has given us each other, but human beings are only finally like a temporary way station on the way of God, and then one day it's going to be like a mystical getting absorbed by the blob of God's beauty, and we're all going to leave each other behind. Dante is taken on a tour in the Divine Comedy to three places: the Inferno, Purgatory, and Heaven, Paradise. Anybody remember who the tour guide is for Inferno and for Purgatory? Virgil. But Virgil, who wrote the Aeneid, the great Greco-Roman poet and pagan, he can't be the tour guide for Paradise because he's the pagan. So who shows up famously to be the tour guide for Paradise? You remember? Beatrice. And Beatrice is almost certainly the same Beatrice that we know historically was kind of the one that got away for Dante romantically. He fell in love with her when he was young, and she was in a different social category than him, and they couldn't get married, and he got into an arranged marriage with somebody else later on. And there's a good argument made that this for him represented the ultimate experience of, if I just got this, I'd be happy. I just got this, I'd be complete, which is what romance is for many of us. And she becomes the tour guide on the way to God. And all he wants is for her to turn around and smile at him. He's not all that interested in God. He's interested in Beatrice. And at the very end, she finally turns to him and she smiles at him. And his heart opens up and awakes. But then, and many modern readers find this profoundly inhumane as well. And then she turns her face away. And Dante says that she looks into the eternal fountain of light and beckons Dante to look that way too. Which is great. It's a reminder that other human beings are our portal to God. They are mediators. They are ways of helping us to connect with God. But if all you have is Dante and Beatrice, you might think, Beatrice is gone, now it's only God, and that's all human beings are, and we're going to finally lose each other. And so here's the other one that I love, and I don't think Dante's saying that. In his Confessions, this ex-idolater, this ex-addict of sex and status and people's praise, is one of the main things he remembers as an old man is the friends that are now gone. Libridius, Alypius, all these guys, they're all from Africa, they all got involved in a cult called the Manichees. And the Libridius is a friend who died decades ago. I'm going to end with this. And Augustine is remembering, and he hasn't seen the Libridius for decades, basically a BFF along with Alypius. They're just great friends when they're younger. He really misses his friend. And one of the things he remembers is the Libridius actually helped get Augustine out of this cult, the Manichees, because Augustine was very vain. And so a lot of the stuff in the cult appealed to him, but the Libridius was a truth seeker. And so he saw this cult is saying a lot of stupid stuff. Like, it's really wrong. And he gets Augustine and the other guy, Alypius, out of the cult. And then Libridius becomes a Christian later through Augustine. And it's been decades since he died. And I want you to read this. One of the final things Augustine says in Book 9, which is the last book of the autobiography, is he says this: Libridius was a most ardent seeker after truth. Soon after my conversion and regeneration by your baptism, he too, and he's talking to God in prayer, he too became a baptized Christian believer. He was serving you, Lord, in perfect chastity and continence among his own people in Africa, and through him, his entire household later became Christians, and yet you released him from his bodily life much too young. So the Libridius died probably as my age, decades before. And Augustine is remembering as an old man, his friend that he loved, who was instrumental in him getting on the path of truth, and then he misses deeply. And he says, now he lives in Abraham's bosom. That story in Luke 16. Here's why Augustine grabs that language. Whatever is meant by Abraham's bosom, which is a great word, Augustine's like, I have no idea what that means. That is where my sweet dear friend Libridius now lives. Your former freedman, Lord, and now your adopted son. There he lives, for what other place could hold such a remarkable soul? There he lives, in that place concerning which he used to put so many questions to me, I, a poor man without much knowledge at all. But Augustine, remember, the British is always asking, well, what happens to Christians after they die? And Augustine says, he's there now. And then he says this, Nebridius no longer pricks up his ear when I speak like he used to. But now he puts his spiritual mouth to your fountain, and he avidly drinks as much as he can of your wisdom, O Lord, happy without end. And you might stop there and be like, okay, so now he's connected to God. He doesn't need Augustine anymore. Augustine doesn't need him. And then Augustine says, but I do not think him so intoxicated by that fountain of wisdom as to have forgotten me, since you, O Lord, of whom he drinks, are mindful of us and do not forget us. We will never leave our neighbors behind. We will always connect to our Creator, loving him with all our hearts, souls, and mind, by loving our neighbor, and we will always love our neighbors by loving God with all of our hearts and our mind. This is a feature of creation that human beings are supposed to be here. And so this is a call to not only not be idolaters, but to seek God primarily in your seeking of one another and loving and being loved by people who are themselves seeking to love and be loved by their Creator. Your experience of God will always finally be bound up with your experience of one another. Do not isolate yourselves from one another. Do not try to be a lone ranger. Do not try to put on a mask that convinces people you are someone that you are not. Be who you are with others who are all also following Jesus. And I promise you that in the long run, nothing will make the beauty, the presence, the reality of God seem more real to you than the degree of your relationships with other people who are also turned towards him rather than away from him, the created order. And so here is a solution. Love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Little children, do not be idolaters. Do not give your hearts to idols. Let's pray.